be here, Thatcher said. She's been asking for him. He sighed. I got your messages. Sounds like everything is going well there.
Going well? Adrian said.
Isn't it?
At that moment, Adrian heard a muted cheer from the kitchen, and Kat stepped out, hoisting her tool belt in victory. Adrian blew her a kiss as she ran out the door. Sure, Adrian said.
Good. I'll see you tomorrow night. We'll be on the 4 o'clock flight, so I hope to make the menu meeting. How many covers are on the book?
235, Adrian said.
Whoa, Thatcher said. It's July. Hey, would you call Jack at the flower shop in the morning and have him deliver fresh hydrangeas on Monday? I want it to look nice when Fee comes back.
No problem, Adrian said.
I miss you, Thatcher said. Do you miss me?
I do, she said. She hung up the phone. She felt better, like she was the one whose exhaust fan had been broken, and now she sucked in clean, fresh air. The phone rang again, private line. Adrian had to do 2 rounds through the dining room, but she picked up the phone in case it was Thatcher with one last thing. It wasn't Thatcher, but Adrian was glad she took the call anyway. Harry Henderson informed her, in a voice both jubilant and humbled, of the birth of Sebastian Robert Elpern, 9 pounds, 12 ounces, perfect in every way, and of an official offer on the Blue Bistro for $8.5 million. Chapter 9. Phosphorescence. The Inquirer and Mirror, week of July 15th, 2005. Here and There column. There have been several reports of phosphorescence in the water at beaches along the North Shore this week. Phosphorescence is caused by a type of algae called dinoflagellates, which are capable of bioluminescence when the water they reside in is disturbed. Sports Illustrated cover story. The Heroes of America's Heartland. Can the White Sox win the pennant? To addy12177@hotmail.com from Kira Crenshaw at mindspring.com. Date July 13, 2005, 9:02 a.m. Subject, things I can't believe. I can't believe you've traded in the cushy life of the hotel front desk for the restaurant business. I can't believe you're dating your boss. I can't believe you're living with my dreamboat, Duncan. You should thank me for recommending Nantucket. You should remember me in your will. To Kira Crenshaw at mindspring.com from addy12177@hotmail.com. Date, July 13th, 2005, 10:35 a.m. Subject, thank you. Thank you for recommending Nantucket. I am in a much better place, following my new rules, feeling good about myself. I paid off both Mr. Visa and Ms. MasterCard, and I have a positive bank balance. I am in a relationship with a real, live, grown-up man. I sing in the shower. It is amazing, Kira, the way that happiness changes a person. To addy12177@hotmail.com from Kira Crenshaw at mindspring.com. Date, July 14th, 2005, 8:41 a.m. Subject, the way that happiness changes a person. Is happiness contagious? Can you send me some spores in the mail? When Fiona returned from Boston, Adrian studied her for signs of illness, but Fiona had never looked better. One very busy Thursday night, the kitchen was waist deep in the weeds. The kitchen had so many tickets, there wasn't enough room for them above the pass. The Subiacos were sweating and cursing and busting their humps to keep up. Fiona slid behind the line to plate soups, sauce pasta, and sauté foie gras while singing, "The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow." Every time Adrian peeked her head in, she found Fiona in soaring good spirits. "One plate at a time," Fiona called out. She even helped Jojo, the youngest Subiaco, load the dishwasher. She was a general in a foxhole with her men, but singing, gleeful. It was strange. Adrian thought maybe the hospital had given Fiona a personality transplant. It didn't take Adrian long to figure out that Fiona's improvement in attitude had nothing to do with the hospital or facing her own mortality. It had, very simply, to do with love. Right after first seating, Jay-Z walked in. Shaughnessy was away at camp, and he had rented a house on Liberty Street. Today was day one of a week's vacation. Fiona and Jay-Z were inseparable. By day three, they had established a routine. They did yoga together on the beach in the mornings, and then Jay-Z helped Fiona in the kitchen. One morning, Adrian found him pitting Bing cherries and joking with the Subiacos. The Subiacos were in a collective good mood because the White Sox had won 11 straight and held first place by a game and a half. Fiona and Jay-Z escaped from the kitchen by noon with a picnic basket, and off they would go in Fiona's Range Rover to secret, out-of-the-way beaches where no one would ever find them. Jay-Z ate dinner at the bar and spent the hour after second seating in the kitchen. And Adrian knew that after eating with Thatch, Fiona drove her Range Rover to the house on Liberty Street and spent the night. Was happiness contagious? By day four, it was safe to say that the food at the bistro had never been better, and Adrian wasn't sure how to explain that. How did the best get better? It just did. Every single guest raved about the food. Perfectly seasoned, perfectly cooked, the freshest, the creamiest, the most succulent, the best I've ever had. Adrian noticed it too, at family meal. The Asian shrimp noodles, the croque-monsieur, the steak sandwiches with creamy horseradish sauce, and crispy Vidalia onion rings. Are you kidding me? Adrian thought as she stuffed her face. She thought, Jay-Z, never leave. On day five, Adrian was working reservations when the private line rang. By this time, Adrian realized the private line could be anybody. Thatcher, who was at an AA meeting, Kat, Dottie Shore, Harry Henderson, Ernie Ottemeyer, Leon Cross, Father Ott. Good morning, Blue Bistro, Adrian said. A woman's voice said, This is Jamie Zodal. I'm looking for my husband. Have you seen him? Adrian found herself at a loss. I'm sorry? Your husband? Jasper Zodal, Jay-Z. There's no need to play games. I know you know who he is, and I know he's there. Or if he's not there now, he'll be there at some point, and I want to speak to him. Adrian wrote Jay-Z's name at the top of her reconfirmation sheet. She thought of Shaughnessy at summer camp, and all the things that might have gone wrong. Sunburn, mosquito bites, sprained ankle, homesickness. He normally delivers here at 10, Adrian said, but he's on vacation this week. You can cut the crap, Jamie said. I'm not stupid. Have him call me, his wife, at his house. He knows the number. Okay, if I see him. Jody Zodal hung up. Adrian passed on the message that evening when Jay-Z came into the bar for dinner. He was wearing a dolphin blue button-down shirt, and his face and forearms were very tan. He and Fiona had rented a sunfish that afternoon and sailed on Cascada Pond. Adrian delivered the bad news with his chips and dip. Your wife called this morning, she said. Here? Adrian nodded. She wants you to call her at home. Can't be important, he said. Or she would have called me on my cell. I had it on all day. She probably just called to make a point, to let everyone know she knows I'm here. Okay, well, Adrian said, that was the message. Later that night, as they lay in bed, Adrian asked Thatcher what he knew about Jamie Zodal. She's unhappy, he said. She's one of those people who thinks the next thing is going to save her. When I first met her 12 years ago, she was desperate to marry Jay-Z. They used to come into the restaurant all the time. He proposed to her at table 20. Oh, you're kidding, Adrian said. After they got married, Jamie wanted to be pregnant. That didn't happen right away, and they went to Boston for fertility help, and it worked, obviously, because they had Shaughnessy.
But then Jamie realized how hard it was to be a mother. So to afford a live-in, she and Jay-Z sold their house here and moved to Sandwich. Jamie had an affair with the guy who owned the gym that she joined, and Jay-Z found out. Jamie promised to break it off, and they went into counseling for a while, and Jay-Z took a job driving for another company so he wouldn't have to be gone every day. We didn't see him here for 2 whole summers, but then he found out Jamie was back with the guy from the gym, and he gave up. Got his old job back, and he's been trying to file for divorce, but Jamie won't let him. She threatens to take Shaughnessy away, and she disappears to her mother's in Charlottesville. And once she and Shaughnessy flew to London for the weekend. The only way Jay-Z was able to find them was by calling his credit card company. Jamie has run them into mountains of debt on top of it all. Pretty woman, gorgeous. But what a disaster. Thatcher rubbed his eyes. Jay-Z used to talk to Fiona about the whole thing. It was strange because Fiona and I and the staff had watched the relationship from the beginning. The courtship, the proposal, the wedding, the child, the breakup. And next thing I knew, Fiona and Jay-Z were in love.
When was that?
2 years ago.
So what do you think will happen, then?
What do I think will happen?
Thatcher repeated. He was lying on his back, arms folded over his chest, like someone resting in a coffin.
Nothing will happen.
What does that mean?
Jay-Z won't leave Jamie. He's too cowardly.
He's worried about his daughter.
That's what he says.
You don't believe him?
Jay-Z is a good guy, Thatcher said. But he's not going to risk anything for Fiona. Leave his wife and lose his daughter for someone who's going to die.
Thatcher rolled onto his side, away from Adrian.
That would take a hero. Jay-Z is nobody's hero.
Happiness might be contagious, but it was also fleeting, delicate, mercurial. On day 6, Jamie called again, in the middle of second seating. The restaurant was loud, but Adrian picked up a new tone in Jamie's voice. She sounded manic and untethered, like someone who had pounded 6 shots of espresso. "This is Jamie Zodal," she said. "Is Jay-Z there?" "Yes," Adrian said. "Please hold on 1 minute." "You hold on 1 minute," Jamie said. "Excuse me?" "I know Fiona's sick," Jamie said. "I know all about it." Adrian said nothing. Across the room, a table burst out laughing. Rex played In the Mood. "Let me get Jay-Z," Adrian said. "I have a phone number," Jamie said, "for a journalist who wants to write about her. He wants to talk to me about Fiona and Jay-Z. The question is, do I want to talk to him?" "Let me get Jay-Z," Adrian said again, though she was afraid to put Jamie on hold. Bruno swung by the podium. "I need your help on 10, he said. "Can you pull a bottle of the cake bread?" Adrian's ears were buzzing. She felt like she had a bomb threat on the phone. "Get Jay-Z," Adrian whispered to Bruno. "His wife is on the phone." Bruno wasn't listening closely. What he heard was Adrian asking him for something in response to his asking her for something. He wagged a finger. "Honey, I'm slammed. Can you get the wine for me, please?" Adrian searched the dining room for Thatcher. Her eyes snagged on table 10, a deuce, a middle-aged couple, fidgeting, glancing around. They wanted their wine. Adrian snapped back to her senses. This was a restaurant. She put Jamie Zodal on hold, zipped into the wine cave for a cake bread, then she shouted into the kitchen, "Jay-Z, call for you on line 3. By the time Adrian opened the wine for table 10 and made it back to the podium, the phones were quiet. Jamie had hung up. Adrian didn't see Jay-Z on day 7, but she gathered he had packed up and left. Fiona took a day off. When she returned, she was back to her old sarcastic, scowling self. The White Sox lost a doubleheader to the Mariners. Adrian stayed out of the kitchen. To Kira Crenshaw at Mindspring.com, from Addie12177@hotmail.com. Date, January 21st, 2005, 10:35 a.m. Subject, happiness. Not sending spores. You don't want them. Happiness is fickle. Plays favorites. A couple of days later, Adrian was working the phone when a man walked in dressed entirely in black. Black jeans, black shoes, black dress shirt open at the neck. Bulky black duffel bag. He was a young guy who had shaved his head to hide his baldness, so all Adrian could see was something like a 5 o'clock shadow where his hair used to be. New York, Adrian thought, and immediately her guard went up. The press. Who else dressed in black on a hot July day at the beach?
Can I help you? Adrian said.
He offered her his pale hand.
Lyle Hardaway, he said. Vanity Fair magazine.
Yep. Adrian eyed her phone. If he didn't leave when she asked, she would call the police. I'm sorry, Adrian said. You don't have an appointment and our owner isn't here. He held up his palm.
I have a meeting scheduled with Mario Subiaco. He said he'd be working. He said I should come here.
He did?
Yeah, Mario, the pastry chef. This is the Blue Bistro.
It is. Blue bitch voice. She pointed a finger at his raised hand. You wait right here. Don't move. Is there a camera in that bag?
Yes, he said.
No photographs, she said. Understand?
Okay, he said,
and he smiled like maybe this tough act of hers was supposed to be funny. Adrian marched into the kitchen. She heard Fiona's voice in the walk-in. She was making an order list with Antonio. Adrian slipped into pastry. Mario was all gussied up in his houndstooth pants, washed and pressed, and his dress whites, the jacket with black piping and his name over the chest pocket. He was rolling out dough.
You have a visitor, Adrian said.
He didn't look up.
Do I?
Lyle somebody. From Vanity Fair.
Okay, Mario said.
He's not coming back here, Adrian said.
Yeah, he is, Mario said. He wants to watch me work. I'm making my own pretzels today, for chocolate-covered pretzels. It's a special on the candy plate.
I thought there was no press allowed in the kitchen, Adrian said. I thought that was a law.
This isn't the kitchen, Mario said. It's pastry.
Does Fiona know this guy is coming? Adrian asked.
Not yet.
Adrian watched Mario fiddle with the pretzel dough, twisting it into nifty shapes. What's going on? She said.
They're doing an article about me, he said.
Just about you?
Just about me. I hired a publicist.
You did what?
I hired a publicist, and she sent out my picture and my CV, and Vanity Fair called. They're doing some article about sex in the kitchen. You know, sexy chefs, Rocco DiSpirito, Todd English, and me.
He raised his face from his work and mugged for her.
Now I've heard it all, Adrian said.
You hired a publicist, and you have a writer from a huge New York magazine in the bistro with a camera to take pictures of you making chocolate-covered pretzels because you're sexy.
King of the Sweet Ending, he said. They love the name.
Yeah, well, Fiona doesn't know. And guess what? I'm not telling her.
No one was asking you to.
So you'll tell her yourself?
Tell her why? It's my business.
It's not your business, Adrian said. It's her business.
Just send the guy back, please, Adrian.
As Adrian returned to the dining room, Lyle Hardaway was right where she'd left him. The phone rang. Darla Parrish, bumping her reservation to three people. Adrian asked cautiously, hoping, praying, "Not Wolfie?" No, it's our youngest son, Luke. I can't wait to introduce you. Oh, and Adrian, dear, will you put us at that new table?
Sure thing, Adrian said. She made a note on her reconfirmation list. The writer was watching her every move. She hung up the phone, then said, Follow me. Adrian and Lyle Hardaway made it 3 steps into the kitchen before Fiona stopped them.
Whoa, she said. Whoa.
Who's this? Not a wine rep back here. His name is Lyle Hardaway. Adrian was afraid to say more.
Is he a friend of yours? Fiona asked.
No, Adrian said. Suddenly, Mario appeared from the back.
He's here for me.
What is he, your new dance instructor? Fiona said.
She glared at Lyle Hardaway.
Who are you?
I'm a writer for Vanity Fair, he said. He offered Fiona his hand.
You're Fiona Kemp.
It's an honor to meet you. Fiona pointed to the door. Her cheeks were starting to splotch, and she bent her head and coughed a little into her hand. Antonio spoke up from behind the pass.
Get him out of here, Adrian, he said,
and Adrian thought, yes, get him out before he sees Fiona cough.
Fuck off, Tony, Mario said. He's here for me.
Antonio said,
What are you, crazy?
Fiona spoke to the floor.
I have to ask you to leave, she said. I don't allow press in the kitchen.
Come on, Fee, Mario said in a voice that normally got him whatever he wanted.
He's here to take pictures of my pretzels.
No,
Fiona said. Lyle Hardaway held his arms in front of his face, like the words were being hurled at him.
Maybe I should wait out front while you work this out.
Wait outside, Fiona said, in the parking lot.
Lyle Hardaway disappeared through the door. Fiona slammed her hand on the pass.
And now there will be a line in Vanity Fair or one of the other magazines they're sleeping with, you can bet on it, about what a bitch I am.
She glared at Mario.
What were you thinking? You invited him into our kitchen?
He wants to write an article about me, Mario said.
No, Fiona said.
You can't tell me no, Mario said.
The article is about me. It's not about you. It's not about the bistro. That's where you're wrong, Fiona said. He told you the article is about you, but that was just so he could get through the door. Did you hear him a second ago? You're Fiona Kemp. It's an honor to meet you. He's using you to get to me.
Mario laughed and looked around the kitchen at his cousins and his brother Luis, who was filling ravioli and pretending not to listen. Only Adrian was captive, rooted in the kitchen, afraid to leave lest she attract attention to herself, or worse, miss something.
I cannot believe how self-centered you are, Mario said. You think the world revolves around your tiny ass? It does not. You think people care so much about you? They do not. That man came here to interview me. And I'm going to let him. Because my career isn't over in September, Fee. I have to move on. I have to build my prospects, increase the value of my stock. So maybe I get investors and open my own place. Maybe my cousin Henry gets investors for his root beer. We have to move on, Fee. Move forward. We aren't quitting at the end of the summer.
I'm not quitting either, Fiona whispered.
The bistro is closing, Mario said. That's a fact. The building is sold. It's torn down. It's rebuilt as somebody's fat mansion. There is no more bistro. So what do you expect us to do? Lie down and die with you?
Mario,
Antonio said.
Get out,
Fiona shouted. She whipped around and caught Adrian standing there, but she didn't seem to care. Her eyes were ready to spill over with tears.
Was Adrian going to see Fiona cry? Get out! Get out of my kitchen!
Mario ripped off his chef's jacket and threw it to the floor.
Fine, he said. I'm finished with you.
He stormed out the door, leaving the kitchen in a stunned silence. Adrian felt a strong desire to run after him. She liked Mario, and she saw his point. Once the bistro closed, everyone had to fend for himself. Fiona would be $4 million richer. But where would the rest of them be? Fiona retreated to the office and slammed the door. Adrian heard the faint ringing of the phone. She went out front to answer it. That was her job. That night there were 244 covers on the book. Family meal was pulled pork, corn muffins, grilled zucchini, and summer squash. At the menu meeting, Thatcher announced that there would be no desserts. All Antonio had been able to find back in pastry were a few gallons of peanut butter ice cream, a tray of popsicles, and the unfinished pretzels.
I'll say one thing for my cousin, Antonio said. He works fresh.
No one knew where Mario was. At last report, he hadn't checked in at the Subiaco compound. Adrian wondered if he had flown off-island in search of another job. She wondered if she would ever see him again. What do you think? Adrian asked Thatcher at the podium as they awaited first seating.
I stay out of the kitchen's business.
Yeah, but what do you think?
Fee's afraid, he said quietly. And fear does strange things to people.
It's too bad, Adrian said. They've been friends a long time.
They're still friends, Thatcher said. This is just a fight.
So you think he'll come back?
Where's he going to go?
Thatcher said.
I don't know. Chicago?
Ha!
Thatcher gave her the laugh, and Adrian felt better. She was smiling when the Parrishes walked in.
Hello,
Darla called out. She was holding a young man by the hand, pulling him along like he was Wolfie's age.
Adrian, this is my son, Luke Parrish. Thatcher, you remember Luke.
Thatcher shook hands with Luke and patted him on the back. Luke smiled shyly at the floor. He was the exact opposite of what Adrian expected a Parrish son to look like. He wore tiny, frameless glasses, and he had long brown hair that spilled over his shoulders and down his back. He wore a blue blazer over a white t-shirt, jeans, and sandals. Between the lapels of his jacket, Adrian could only read a single word printed on the front of his shirt. Castro.
It's nice to meet you, Luke, Adrian said. Let me show you to your table.
As she walked the Parrishes out to the awning, Rex launched into, Hello, Dolly. Adrian heard Darla behind her.
Isn't she just lovely? Isn't she exquisite? She used to live in Aspen and Hawaii. Adrian's a real adventure girl, aren't you, Adrian?
Adrian pulled out a chair for Darla. She handed Luke and Grayson their menus. Just to let you know, there aren't any desserts tonight. Our pastry chef is on vacation.
On vacation in the middle of July? Grayson said.
He leaned closer to Luke.
That must mean they fired him.
So I'll get your drinks then, Adrian said. Stoli tonic and Southern Comfort old-fashioned. Luke, what can I bring you?
A beer, please, he said.
We have Cisco Summer Brew on tap, is that okay?
Perfect, he said. And a shot of tequila, please.
A beer and a shot of tequila, Adrian said. I'll be right back.
She put in the drink order with Duncan and went back to the kitchen to give Paco the VIP order. Antonio was expediting.
Where's Fiona?
Adrian asked Paco.
Lying down, he said. She's upset.
About Mario?
No, Paco said. Something about Jay-Z.
Eddie got the story.
Have you heard from Mario? Adrian asked.
Paco scoffed.
He's out getting drunk somewhere, getting drunk and looking for ladies. You think? Adrian said. She seemed to be the only one who was worried about him. She couldn't bear to peek around the corner and see the abandoned pastry station. Back in the dining room, she sat tables. The local author was in, Mr. Kennedy, a real jackass named Doyle Chambers, and one of the local contractors with a party of 12. Adrian opened a bottle of champagne for Kennedy. His wife, Mitzi, was now a devotee of the Lorraine Perrier, and then she swung back into the kitchen to pick up the chips for Parrish and put in two more VIP orders. She headed for the Parrish's table. From behind, Luke looked like a girl in men's clothing. But that wasn't quite right. His hair wasn't feminine, so much as biblical. He looked like the original Luke, the one who wrote the gospel. But this Luke had inherited the Parrish demeanor. Adrian found the three of them sitting in silence, sipping their drinks. The shot of tequila had been drained and pushed to the edge of the table. Adrian scooped it up as she set down the chips and dip. "Another?" she asked Luke.
"Please," he said.
This seemed to startle Darla from her reverie.
"Oh, Adrian, honey, won't you please stay and chat with us for a second?"
"I'd love to."
"I told Darla that arranged marriages have been out of fashion for over 100 years, Grayson said. "She refuses to believe me."
Darla laughed and threw her hand in the air.
"I just thought they might have something in common.
Luke loves to travel. After Amherst, he spent a year in Egypt." "Egypt?" Adrian said. "I've always wanted to see that part of the world. I had a boyfriend once who offered to take me to Morocco, and at times I regret not going." Luke tented his fingers. He was looking at Adrian longingly, she thought, but then she realized that he was eyeing the empty shot glass in her hands. He wanted his tequila.
"How old are you, Adrian?" Darla asked.
28.
"And Luke is 29, Darla said. "He's our youngest."
"And our nuttiest," Grayson piped in. "It was a hard lesson, but I finally learned that our three boys were not mined from the same quarry. This guy,"
and here he pounded Luke on the shoulder,
"is a free spirit."
"Josh and Timmy are more traditional," Darla said.
"They're into wearing suits and paying alimony," Luke said.
"Okay, well," Adrian said, "I'll get you another tequila. Darla, Grayson, can I bring you anything else right now?"
"Just yourself when you have a minute," Darla said.
Adrian stopped at the bar to order another tequila and then met Thatcher at the podium. Everyone from First was down.
"I think Darla is trying to set me up with her son," Adrian said.
"Oh, I know she is," Thatcher said. "For years she's been wondering if he's gay. She told me on Tuesday that it was her intention to introduce him to you."
"And what did you say?"
"I said, good luck. I hear she's very picky."
Adrian swatted him. "Not picky enough."
"I want to have a meeting after closing tonight," Thatcher said.
"A meeting?"
"On the beach outside my office."
"Because of Mario?"
"Morale booster," he said. "It's mandatory. Please spread the word."
No one on the staff expressed enthusiasm about a mandatory meeting at 1 o'clock in the morning. Joe looked at Adrian cross-eyed. Spillman claimed he had a date with his wife at Chipino's.
"Morale booster," he said. "What are we going to do, have a sing-along around the campfire?"
Karen, who was standing right there, said,
"Thatch likes to give a little speech when the first person burns out." She nudged Spillman.
"Last year, remember when Bruno lost his shit on that woman with the alligator shoes? Thatch gave us the talk, and we all got a raise?"
"True," Spillman said.
Tyler Lefroy asked if there would be beer. Adrian was too afraid to tell anyone in the kitchen about the meeting. She would make Thatcher handle that. Between their appetizer and entree, Adrian visited the Parrishes again.
she had to admit, Luke Parrish fascinated her, not because of anything he said or did, but because he was so different from Darla and Grayson. He was a revolutionary. He ordered the mixed green salad with beets and the ravioli. He was a vegetarian. And now, after 2 beers and 3 shots of tequila, Adrian could tell he was getting drunk. His posture was falling apart. He was slumped in his seat. "How's everyone doing here?" Adrian asked. Again, the empty glass of tequila had been pushed to the edge of the table, and Adrian picked it up and held it discreetly at her side. "Would you like another?" she asked Luke.
"No more tequila," Grayson said.
Luke sank a little lower in his chair. Adrian was afraid he might slip under the table. Darla, for the first time ever, seemed distressed. She looked at Luke imploringly, as though she wanted him to speak. He was not picking up whatever signal she was trying to send. She laughed.
"Well, I suppose I might as well say it. Adrian, Luke would like to take you out to dinner on your night off. He'd like to take you to Cinco."
Luke put both his hands on the table, and Adrian noticed he was wearing a silver pinky ring. What to say? That she didn't normally go out with men who had their mothers ask? Luke pushed himself out of the chair.
"I have to piss," he said,
and he propelled himself toward the men's room. Darla pretended not to have heard this last declaration. She smiled at Adrian.
"I hear Cinco has wonderful tapas."
Adrian glanced around the dining room. There were no emergencies calling her name, and there was no one available to save her. She lowered herself into Luke's vacant seat. "Thank you for thinking of me," she said. "But I'm already seeing someone." Darla put her hand to her throat. She looked stunned.
"Who?"
Adrian took another look around. She felt the way a criminal must feel just before breaking the law. She was going to tell Darla and Grayson the truth. Tell them because she wanted to, even though she could feel indiscretion coating her tongue like a film. "Thatcher."
"No."
This came from Grayson.
"Thatcher," Darla said. "You and Thatcher?"
"That's a dead-end street, my girl," Grayson said. "A dead-end street."
He picked up his wine glass and swirled his white burgundy aggressively.
"Let me ask you a question. Why would someone as beautiful and smart and charming as yourself pick someone like Thatcher? Don't you want stability, a house, children? Don't you want, someday, to be one of these soccer moms with everything in its place?"
"I thought you liked Thatcher," Adrian said. "I thought you loved him." Darla put her hand on top of Adrian's hand.
"Thatcher is a dear, sweet fellow, and one of our very favorites, but he's a restaurant person."
Adrian felt her temper rear up, though she knew they had arrived at this place in the conversation because of her own stupidity. "So am I."
"Why, one of the first things you told us is that you've never worked in restaurants. You said this was just another adventure. You aren't like the other people who work here. You aren't like them at all."
"Restaurants are as risky as the theater," Grayson said. "They're as derelict as television. It's a volatile and transient life. It's goddamn make-believe."
"Honey, now you're being dramatic," Darla said.
"Am I?"
Grayson pitched forward in his chair.
"What do your parents think of this?"
"My parents?" Adrian panicked. She didn't want to answer a question about her parents. She wanted to defend restaurant people and restaurant life and all the exciting, diverse, and enriching aspects of it. She wanted to tell them that she was as happy as she'd ever been in her life because of this restaurant. But instead, Adrian did what any good restaurant person would have done. She salvaged the moment. "I really love you too," she said. She flashed them her biggest, toothiest smile. "Thank you for the vote of confidence. And if I ever come across a good prospect for Luke, I'll let you know." She stood up and touched Darla's shoulder. "Your dinners will be out shortly." Adrian dropped off the empty glass at the bar, picked up her flute of Laurent Perrier, and returned to the podium. The podium was her home. At 12:30 that night, Thatcher slipped through the throng at the bar holding the cash box and a wad of receipts close to his chest. "I'm going to eat," he said. Adrian had just finished a stack of crackers. Hector had brought them out to her, along with the news that Mario was still MIA.
"No news is good news," Hector said. "They find him in his Durango at the bottom of Gibbs Pond. That's bad news."
40 minutes later, Duncan rang the handbell. The decibel level in the bar increased. The frenzy for one more drink looked like the scene shown on TV of the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Guests' hands shot in the air, waving money. In her change purse, Adrian had $400 in tips. 200 of it had been palmed to her by Grayson Parrish, possibly as an apology for his tirade, but more likely an apology for Luke's bizarre and ultimately miserable behavior. He hadn't returned from the men's room for a long time, and Grayson was forced to check on him. Luke had vomited and was trying to clean up the mess with toilet paper. Adrian sent Tyler Lefroy into the men's room with the mop. Why did he get all the foul jobs, he wanted to know. And Grayson led Luke back to the table, where he stared down at his ravioli but didn't eat a bite. "This is who you want me to go out with?" Adrian thought. "This is your idea of stability?" After last call, the bar crowd thinned and eventually disappeared. Duncan cashed out, tipped his sister, and poured drinks for the waitstaff and Eddie and Hector, who were waiting around for the meeting to begin. Eddie filled Adrian in on the story circulating about Jay-Z and Jamie. Jamie had found out from a realtor friend on the island that the house Jay-Z rented on Liberty Street went for $3,000 a week. In furious revenge, Jamie had bought a hot tub from Sears. Meanwhile, the director of Shaughnessy's summer camp called threatening to send Shaughnessy home because her tuition had yet to be paid. Jay-Z was, in Eddie's words, wickedly screwed because Fiona had paid for the house on Liberty Street. But Jay-Z didn't want to admit that to Jamie, and Jamie had spent Shaughnessy's camp money on the hot tub. Jay-Z had gone home to straighten out the mess, and in the end, Fiona had paid the summer camp.
"Because she's cool like that," Eddie said. "She's the coolest."
Adrian checked her watch. It was 2:40. Her feet hurt. "Okay, people, let's go," she said. "Beach outside Thatcher's office." They exited through the dining room and walked around the restaurant to the back door of the office. There they found Thatcher and Fiona eating popsicles at a plastic resin picnic table. Fiona was wearing jean shorts and her chef's jacket. Her hair was down. It was lovely and wavy, released from its braid, but her face looked drawn. Adrian and the rest of the staff plopped down in the sand, and Thatcher called for the remaining kitchen staff, Antonio, Henry, Paco, Jojo. When everyone was seated in the sand, he did a strange thing. He lifted Fiona up out of her chair and carried her toward the water.
"Follow me," he said.
The staff followed, including Adrian, who couldn't help feeling stupidly jealous that Thatcher was carrying Fiona. Fiona screamed in protest, her head thrown back, her hair streaming in the breeze. It was a beautiful night, moonless still. The staff trudged to the water's edge, but Thatcher plunged right in until he was up past his knees. He let Fiona go, and she splashed into the water, and the water lit up around her like a force field.
"Whoa," said Paco.
Adrian knew he and Luis had been smoking dope back in pastry.
"That's cool."
Delilah was the next one in because she was young and unabashed about swimming in her clothes. She dove under, and again, the water illuminated around her. Soon the whole staff, including Adrian, was in the ocean, marveling at the way the water sparkled and glowed around their arms and legs.
"Phosphorescence," she heard Thatcher say.
In the dark, she couldn't tell which body was his.
"I didn't want any of you to miss it."
Thatcher had called this a morale booster, but Adrian's heart was aching, for reasons unknown. She put her head under and opened her eyes as she waved her hands to light up the water around her. For weeks, she had been so happy, she felt like her life was phosphorescent, like the space she moved about in glowed and sparkled around her. But now, this minute, that notion seemed silly and wrong. "You're not like the other people who work here. You're not like them at all." The Parishes were right, though Adrian didn't know how she was different or why that bothered her. Her eyes stung from the salt water. She wanted to be swimming next to Thatcher, and what she really wanted was for it to be her and Thatcher out here alone, just the two of them, floating in the sea of light. But Thatcher had brought them all out here for Fiona's sake. Fiona came first, and she should come first. She was a good person, better than anyone knew, paying for Shaughnessy's camp, tolerating Jay-Z's manipulative wife. She was good, and she was sick. The staff horsed around. Adrian saw Duncan and Karen kissing. Paco grabbed Adrian's ankle and tried to tip her over, but she squirmed from his grip and dove under, feeling the material of her red t-shirt dress swirling around her. There was something about being underwater that made her feel lonely, even amid a group of people. When she surfaced, it was quiet, and Adrian checked to see who was nearby. A man she didn't recognize was treading water next to her, and Adrian became confused until she realized it was Bruno without his glasses. Bruno pointed at the shore, and then Adrian heard some of the Subiacos murmuring in Spanish. A man stood on the beach, silhouetted by the light of the office. He just stood there at first, hands on his hips, menacing.
"Police?" Adrian thought.
"Jay-Z? Drew Amenkeller?" But then, very slowly, the figure started to sway, and the swaying became dancing. The figure was dancing in the sand, and the Subiacos laughed and catcalled, and Adrian heard Fiona shout, "Get in here, Romeo!" He came running toward the water, and Adrian caught a glimpse of his face before he dove into the light. Mario. Chapter 10. Dr. Don. 2. Addy12177@hotmail.com from Kira Crenshaw at mindspring.com. Date July 24th, 2005, 9:01 a.m. Subject: To Hell You Ride. The spores you didn't send me worked. I have officially met a man. 36, divorced, 2 kids. Sounds like my worst nightmare, except I am falling head over heels. Even worse, he is a landscape painter. But his work sells. Some people pay more for his paintings than I paid for my last car. So although my mother is crying about no steady income, he does just fine. In the winters, he goes to Telluride and paints there and skis, and he's asked me to go with him. And I, in turn, will ask you, because I miss you, but also because I think you'd like it. Do you want to join us? To Kira Crenshaw at mindspring.com
From addy12177@hotmail.com. Date, July 24th, 2005, 11:22 a.m. Subject, it's July.
Since when do you plan more than one day in advance? You must be in love.
I hate to admit it, but I am not far from that pitiable state myself. This thing with Thatcher is getting serious. Tomorrow, he will meet the other man in my life. That's right, the good doctor. I'll let you know how it goes. As for this winter, I can't bear to think about it, but I'll keep Telluride in mind.
2. Addy12177@hotmail.com.
From drdon@toothache.com. Date, July 24th, 2005, 11:37 a.m. Subject, a quick don't pick me up. We fly in tomorrow. U.S. Air Flight 307 BWI to Philadelphia. U.S. Air Flight 5990 Philly to Nantucket, arriving around 3. We'll take a cab from the airport to the beach club, and we'll meet you at the restaurant at 6 o'clock sharp.
You'll eat with us? And what about this Thatcher person?
Can't wait to see you, honey. Love, love, love. 2. drdon@toothache.com. From addy12177@hotmail.com. Date, July 24th, 2005, 11:40 a.m. Subject, breakfast and lunch.
Dad, I will not be able to have dinner with you. I have to work dinner. Get it?
As does Thatcher. So reorganize your expectations to include breakfast and lunch. Those are the meals for which I'm available. Breakfast and lunch.
You guys are going to love the beach club. It's the best.
Please tip generously, as they know you're my father.
Love.
I shouldn't have invited them, Adrian said to Karen on the morning of her father and Mavis's arrival. She and Karen were at the kitchen table, which, now that the weather was consistently nice, they had moved out into the backyard. They drank tea and espresso in the sun together on mornings like this one, when Duncan went sailing with Holt Millman, and Thatcher left for the restaurant to give Fiona extra help. No one else's parents come to visit.
Mine certainly don't, Karen said.
She had informed Adrian early on that she was a casualty of the nastiest divorce in history. Duncan and Delilah's parents lived in California and were too old to travel. Fiona's parents didn't like to fly. Thatcher's father was too busy with the stores. Spillman's parents were divorced like Karen's and remarried to other people with whom they had had more children. Spillman had a brother in kindergarten. Joe's mother, Mrs. Peek, had come once years earlier and spent the whole time back in the kitchen teaching Fiona how to make the corn spoon bread that was now on the menu with the swordfish.
In general, though, Karen said, I think the restaurant business attracts people who, you know, want to escape their families.
My father sort of invited himself, Adrian said. I couldn't tell him not to come.
I thought you loved your father, Karen said.
I do, Adrian said. More than anyone in the world.
So you should be happy, Karen said.
Does he know about Thatch?
I told him we're dating, Adrian said.
But there's a lot I didn't explain. He's going to ask why the restaurant is closing. He'll ask about Thatcher and Fiona. He'll ask about next year.
Thatcher will be rich next year, Karen said. That's an answer any father would love to hear.
But what will happen between Thatcher and me? Adrian said. My father will ask.
Have you asked?
No, Adrian admitted. I'm too afraid. With Fiona's illness, it seemed fruitless, not to mention unfair, to ask about the future of their relationship.
Does he tell you he loves you?
No, Adrian said. This was another thing she tried not to dwell on. What about Duncan?
Karen fired off a laugh that sounded like a shrill machine gun.
As far as himself is concerned, I resorted to desperate measures.
One desperate measure was this. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, Karen was flying to Boston to meet her friend Tate for the second night of the Rolling Stones concert. They were playing 3 nights at the Fleet Center. Karen and Tate were then sharing a room at the Ritz-Carlton. Tate was gay, but Karen had not disclosed this fact to Duncan. Duncan, she said, was seething with jealousy, not only about Tate, but about the sixth-row seats that Tate had procured from his very wealthy and very influential friends. Duncan did not like being outdone in the wealthy and influential friends department, hence that morning's sale with Holt.
"It better work," Karen said. "I'm betting all my chips on this one."
True enough. She had basically sold herself in slavery to Bruno to get him to switch nights off with her.
"Well, you're going to miss my father," Adrian said. "Tonight's the only night he's eating at the bistro."
And that only because he insisted. The other two nights, Adrian had booked him at the Pearl and the club car. Thatcher had set Don and Mavis up in a hotel room at the beach club, where reservations in July and August had been booked for 6 months. Thatcher talked to Mac, and Mac had a last-minute cancellation. And so Dr. Don and Mavis were staying in a room on the Gold Coast. Adrian had worried about the price, but her father seemed excited about paying $600 a night for a room. This was a very special vacation, he said, and there would be no skimping. By the time she got to work, Adrian's stomach was churning like Mario's Hobart mixer. There were 247 covers on the book. Family meal was shrimp curry over jasmine rice and a cucumber salad, but Adrian couldn't eat. She begged Mario to make her some of his banana French toast with chocolate syrup. What she needed was comfort food, and Mario bitched about the 250 other people he had to feed that night. Since he had put the writer from Vanity Fair on a plane back to New York without a story, and since he had lost $500 for breaking his contract with his publicist, Mario had gotten good at bitching. He worked too many hours, he made too little money, he wasn't treated like the genius he knew himself to be. Still, Adrian knew that he liked her.
"My father is coming in tonight with his friend," Adrian told him.
"Your father's gay?" Mario asked.
"No," Adrian said. "Why do you ask?"
"The way you said friend sounded funny."
"It is funny," Adrian said. "But he's not gay. The woman he's coming with is his hygienist. She's his employee. Just please don't think it's my mother. Mavis is not my mother. My mother died when I was 12.
Mario crossed himself, then held up his palms.
"I'll make the toast," he said.
But Adrian couldn't eat the French toast either. Her anxiety level rose to her eyebrows every time she reviewed the reservation book. The circle that stood for table 20 said, "Don Dealey." Her father was coming to the restaurant tonight, stepping into her life for the first time since he'd flown to Tallahassee for her college graduation. Always she went to him. She liked it that way. It gave her control. This feeling she had now was a distinctly out-of-control feeling. Thatcher joined her at the podium.
"I missed you today," he said. "What did you do?"
"Sat on the beach and stressed."
"About what?"
"Do I really need to say it?"
"Your father?"
Adrian nodded. She didn't want Thatcher to know how nervous she was, because she wasn't sure she could explain why. Her father meeting Thatcher, Thatcher meeting her father. The disastrous dinner with Will Kovac years earlier festered in her mind. Why was her father coming to see her this year of all years? Why hadn't he come to see her in Hawaii when she was low on friends and spent most of her evenings wallowing in misery over her breakup with Sully? It seemed so much sager to follow the example of her fellow employees and keep family members out of the restaurant. She thought of how morose Tyler Lafroy had looked at the table with his parents and his sister. Tonight, that would be her.
"You haven't noticed my haircut," Thatcher said. "I had Pam squeeze me in because your father was coming."
Adrian looked at him blankly. "You're right," she said. "I didn't notice." She checked her watch. 5 minutes until post time. She wandered over to the bar, and Duncan slid her drink across the blue granite.
"So what do you think about Karen going to see the Stones with this Tate guy?" Duncan said.
Adrian shrugged.
"She's psyched about the concert."
"Yeah, but what about the guy?"
"He's loaded, I guess. He owns a villa on St. Bart's."
"She says they're just friends."
"Of course they're just friends," Adrian said. "You're not worried about Karen."
"They're sharing a hotel room," he said.
"It has two beds," Adrian said. "I'm sure that since the two of you are so happy together, nothing will happen with this Tate person, even if he is rich. And handsome."
"Handsome?"
Adrian tried not to smile. "I saw his picture. The guy looks like George Clooney." She pointed to the row of bottles behind Duncan. "But I'll bet he can't make a lemon meringue pie martini."
"Thanks," Duncan said. "You're a pal." "Hey, your parents are coming in tonight."
Adrian took a long sip of her champagne. "My father," she said, "and his hygienist."
Duncan looked at her strangely.
"My father's a dentist," Adrian said. "He's coming with a woman who works for him, his hygienist."
Duncan smiled. "Sure."
Adrian took another drink. This was more than half the problem, explaining about Mavis. There was no easy way to do it, and yet Adrian had vowed that she was going to be honest. She would not pretend Mavis was her mother. She heard Thatcher say, "You must be..." Adrian slowly turned around to see her father and Mavis standing by the podium. Dr. Don was a good 6'2", and he looked tan and handsome. He'd lost weight, and he was wearing new clothes, a lizard green silk shirt and a linen blazer. Adrian was suddenly overwhelmed with love for him. It was a love that had lasted 28 years and had solely sustained her for the last 16. It was a love that was the ruling order of her life. She was able to exist only because this man loved her. "Dad," she said. He hugged her tight and kissed the top of her head, rocking her back and forth.
"Oh, honey," he said.
Adrian hid her face in the soft material of his shirt.
"I forgot just how much I miss you."
He held her apart.
"Smile."
She had brushed and flossed when she got to work because she knew he would ask. He always did. She smiled, but when she smiled, she felt like she might cry. She took a deep breath and regarded Mavis, who was beaming at her. No, this was not her mother, but Mavis was at least familiar. She had the same haircut, the same frosted coral lipstick, the same minty smell as Adrian kissed the side of her mouth. She wore a red dress with gold buttons. That was new. "Mavis, hi."
"Hi, doll."
The same vaguely annoying nickname. Doll. Mavis called everyone by diminutives. Doll, baby doll, sweetie, sugar, honey pie. Except for Adrian's father, whom she called the doctor when she was speaking about him, and Donald when she was speaking to him. Adrian felt a light hand on her lower back, and she remembered Thatcher. Thatcher, the restaurant. Her job.
"Daddy, Mavis, this is Thatcher Smith, owner of the Blue Bistro. Thatcher, my father, Don Dealey, and Mavis LaRue."
"We just met,"
Thatcher said. He glanced from Adrian to Don and back again.
"I wish I could say I saw a family resemblance."
Don laughed.
"Adrian looks like my late wife,"
he said. He turned to Mavis.
Doesn't she?
Mavis nodded solemnly.
Spitting image.
Adrian plucked two menus from the podium.
Okay, well, she said.
Since you're here, you might as well sit. Follow me. She walked through the dining room to table 20, wobbling a little in her heels. Something felt off. She tried to think. Her father was definitely at table 20. She would seat him, give him a menu, and have Spillman get him a drink. Thatcher would put in the VIP order. Fine. The restaurant was sparkling and elegant. Rex played What a Wonderful World.
This place is not to be believed, Mavis said. And our hotel room. Adrian, doll, you're a marvel. It's the nicest room I have ever stayed in.
Good, Adrian said. I'm glad you like it.
We don't like it, Don said. We love it.
He pulled a chair out for Mavis, then he sat. Adrian stood behind them with the menus. Something still was not right. She felt artificial, like she was play-acting. But no, this was her job. She was the assistant manager of this restaurant and had been for 2 months. When she handed Mavis a menu, she saw the ring. One emerald-cut diamond on a gold band. Immediately, Adrian thought,
Mavis is engaged.
And then she nearly cried out. She closed her eyes.
Okay, she thought.
It's okay. She pictured her mother's face, one eyebrow raised suspiciously, the face Adrian got when she had asked for permission to wear eyeshadow. When Adrian opened her eyes, her vision was splotchy, and she was glad she hadn't eaten anything, because suddenly it felt like someone was holding her upside down underwater. She wavered a little and took her father by the wrist.
Are you okay, sweetheart?
Sorry, Adrian said. In her peripheral vision, she saw Spillman approaching. I haven't eaten anything all day. Good evening, Spillman said. You're Adrian's parents? Dr. Don stood up to shake Spillman's hand, while Mavis smiled at her Limoges charger. Adrian had lost language.
This is my father and his friend, Mavis.
His hygienist, Mavis.
His fiancé, Mavis.
We'll have champagne,
Adrian heard her father say. You'll sit and have a glass with us, Addie? Actually, no, she said. They wanted to tell her. They had come all the way to Nantucket to tell her in person. Meanwhile, Adrian wished her father had simply sent an email. That way she could have digested the news privately. But no. They were going to make her sit through it here, in front of them, while she was supposed to be working. She turned around. There was a cluster of people at the podium. I have to go, she said. Because remember, Dad, I told you. Dr. Don smiled and shooed her off.
Go. I want to watch you.
Suddenly, it was like Adrian was 12 years old again, in the school play. Peppermint Patty in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Adrian's mother had been in the hospital, so Dr. Don came to the play with, yes, Mavis. As if to make up for Rosalie's absence, the two of them had paid extra close attention. After the play was over, they commented on Adrian's every gesture. They remembered each of her 8 stiff lines.
Act natural,
Adrian had thought then, and now. Lee Stanford and her husband were in with friends from Guam. Where did they find these far-flung friends? And Thatcher's hairdresser, Pam, was in with a date. Adrian sat a party of 6 women, then a couple celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary. When Adrian glanced over at her father and Mavis,
They were sipping Laurent Perrier, studying their menus. Her father caught her eye and waved. Adrian went to the bar and reclaimed her second glass of champagne. Charlie, Duncan's friend, owner of the gold marijuana leaf necklace, was seated at the bar drinking a whale's tail ale. He gave Adrian the up-down, as he did every time he came in. It was one of a dozen things about the man that made Adrian shiver with dislike. He smelled like very strong soap.
"This is her roommate?" Charlie asked Duncan.
"Yes," Duncan said. He smirked at Adrian.
"I was just telling Charlie about the stunt Karen pulled."
"It's not a stunt," Adrian said. "She went to a concert."
"With another guy," Charlie said.
"A friend of hers," Adrian said. She glanced back over her shoulder at her father. He waved. Scene where Adrian defends her roommate's decision to share a hotel room with another man. "You have women in here every night throwing themselves at you. You hardly have a right to get angry."
"I'm not angry," Duncan said, "but I'm on to her."
"What's the guy's name again?" Charlie asked.
"Tate something," Duncan said.
"Tate," Charlie said. "Goddamn prep school name if I ever heard one."
"What I don't understand," Duncan said, "is why they're sharing a room if he's so rich and well-connected. He should be able to afford two rooms."
"He didn't want two rooms," Charlie said. "He wants to be in the same room with your bitch." Adrian glanced at Duncan to see how he would react to Karen's being so designated, and Duncan looked at her, possibly for the same reason. Adrian shrugged.
"You eating tonight?" she asked Charlie. "I need a menu."
"Do you want something other than the steak?"
"Maybe," he said.
"Why don't you bring me a menu?" Duncan pulled a menu out from behind the bar. Charlie pretended to study it, his brow wrinkled and threatening. Joe set a highball glass on the bar.
"The woman who ordered this asked for Finlandia on the rocks."
"That is Finlandia," Duncan said.
"She swore it was Grey Goose," Joe said.
"It is Grey Goose," Duncan admitted. His neck started to redden around the collar of his shirt. "We're out of Finlandia. I can't believe she can tell the difference."
"She could tell the difference," Joe said. "She's a serious vodka drinker."
"Tell her we're out of Finlandia," Duncan said. "We have the Grey Goose or 888.
"You're making me look bad," Joe said.
Duncan threw his hands in the air.
"What is this? Beat up the bartender night?"
"Yeah," Charlie said to Joe. "Lay off my friend here. His woman skipped town."
Thatcher came up behind Adrian.
"The VIP order is up for your dad. Would you let Paco know we need three more?"
"Sure," Adrian said. She turned to Charlie and eyed his necklace. It was the dog tag of his stupidity. "Do you know what you'd like?" she asked. "I'm headed for the kitchen. I could put your order in."
"I'll have the steak," he said. "Well done. If there's even a little bit of pink, I'll be sick, I swear."
"Well, we don't want that," Adrian said. She checked one more time on her father. He waved. The kitchen was ridiculously hot. Fiona was drenched in sweat.
"We're short a dishwasher," she said. "Jojo went to see the Rolling Stones last night in the big city and hasn't managed to find his way home. I don't know why one of these clowns didn't go with him, but they'll pay. Paco, when you're done with the chips, your dish, bitch. And Eddie, I don't want to hear one word about the weeds from you."
Paco and Eddie groaned.
"Save the whining for your cousin," Fiona said. "Maybe next time you'll clue him in on how to find the bus station."
She glanced over at Adrian, who was scribbling out a ticket for the bar. "One steak, killed."
"How are you doing?"
"I'm okay," Adrian lied. She held up three fingers for Paco, who started slicing potatoes, muttering curses about Jojo. There was one order of chips and dip up. Adrian took it.
That's for your parents? Fiona asked. My father, Adrian said. The explaining was becoming tedious. And his girlfriend.
His girlfriend? Fiona said.
Yes. There. She'd said it. And it sounded a lot less bizarre than hygienist. Girlfriend. Fiancé. Did it really matter? Adrian's mother had been dead for 16 years. Her father deserved to be happy.
Getting upset about this was as adolescent as partying too hard at the Rolling Stones concert and missing work.
I'll cook for them myself, Fiona said. They're on 20, right?
Adrian was confused.
Right, but you don't have to do that. You have other stuff. The expediting. Fiona took a swig from an enormous Evian bottle. When it's family, I like to do the cooking myself.
Even my family? Adrian said.
Of course, Fiona said. Your family is our family. Adrian re-entered the dining room, slightly cheered. She liked the idea of her father as a shared responsibility. Maybe she could send Fiona to her father's wedding in her place.
Adrian delivered the chips and dip to her father's table.
Hand-cut potato chips with creme fraiche and beluga caviar, she announced.
Honey, this is too much, Dr. Don said.
No, it isn't, Daddy, she said. We do it for people a lot less special than you.
Well, okay then, he said, digging in. Thank you.
Thatcher materialized at the table.
Everyone's down, he said to Adrian. You can have a drink with your dad and Mavis here. You can even order if you'd like.
I ate already, Adrian said tightly.
You told me you haven't eaten anything all day, Dr. Don said. Sit and eat, Thatcher said.
He put his hands on Adrian's shoulders and pushed her into a chair.
I'm going to order you the foie gras and the club.
Please don't, Adrian said. I want to work.
You can work second, Thatcher said. Right now, you should enjoy your family.
Enjoy your family. For so many people, this phrase was a paradox, as tonight it was for Adrian. Still, she didn't want to throw a tantrum or make a scene in the middle of a very full restaurant, so she sank into the wicker chair next to her father, and Spillman brought over her drink.
We should have a toast, Dr. Don said, raising his glass. To you, sweetheart. You've done it again. This island is beautiful.
And the restaurant, Mavis said. I always thought restaurants were, you know, a seedy place to work.
Risky, derelict, volatile, transient, goddamned make-believe, Adrian said. I've heard it all.
But this place is special, Mavis said, as anyone can see.
Thank you, Adrian said.
They clinked glasses. Adrian helped herself to caviar. Across the dining room, she caught Lee Stanford's curious eye. The curse of table 20.
Adrian wished she had a big sign. This is not my mother.
Thatcher is so charming, Mavis whispered.
He really seems to like you.
He does like me, Adrian said.
Do you have any long-term plans? Dr. Don asked.
Long-term?
No.
Right now, I'm celebrating my solvency.
I paid you back, I paid my credit cards off, and I have money in the bank. You should be happy about that.
I am.
Oh, honey, Dr. Don said. If you only knew how much I worried about you.
You don't have to worry, Adrian said. I'm self-sufficient.
Now.
Of course you are, Mavis said.
I keep your picture in my examining room, he said. Everyone asks about you, and I tell them all about my beautiful daughter who lives in Hawaii, Thailand,
Aspen, Nantucket. They always ask if you're married or if you have children, and you tell them no. And I tell them no. But you want to tell them yes. You want me to be a soccer mom with everything in its place. No, honey. Well, what then? I want you to be happy, he said.
I am happy, Adrian snarled.
Good, Mavis said.
And Adrian saw her hand land on Dr. Don's arm,
as if to say, enough already, Donald.
This was a sad state of affairs. There was no one to come to Adrian's defense, except for Mavis.
Anyway, how's Maryland? Adrian asked. You like it?
Oh, yes, Mavis said, clearly relieved at the shift in topic.
You're a doll to ask.
Business is good, Dr. Don said.
And the Eastern Shore is something else, especially now that it's summer. A few weeks ago, we went to Chincoteague to see the wild horses.
We didn't actually see any, Mavis said.
I think we might stay in Maryland a while, Dr. Don said. Settle in. I'm too old to keep moving around so much.
These words had the same effect on Adrian as a drum roll.
Just say it, she thought.
She wanted it over with. Spillman approached with the appetizers. Foie gras for Adrian, corn chowder for Dr. Don, the Caesar, no anchovies, for Mavis. Spillman twisted the peppermill over everyone's plates.
Can I bring you anything else now? He asked.
Kamikaze shot, Adrian said. She stared at him, thinking, get me out of here. Then, finally, she smiled. Only kidding. Spillman's facade never cracked. The man was a professional.
Enjoy your food, he said.
The sun was a juicy pink as it sank toward the water. Rex played As Time Goes By. The foie gras was good enough to shift Adrian's mood from despondent to merely poor. It was deliciously fatty, a heavenly richness balanced by the sweet roasted figs. Who wanted to be married and have children when she could be eating foie gras like this with a front row seat for the sunset? Adrian forgot her manners. She devoured her appetizer in 5 lusty bites, and then she helped herself to more caviar. She was starving. Dr. Don took soup into his spoon, back to front, the way Adrian's mother had taught her 82 years earlier. Adrian tried to imagine what her mother would think about her father and Mavis getting married. It was impossible to imagine Rosalie feeling betrayed or hurt. 16 years, she would say. What took you so long? Adrian couldn't stage a protest to the marriage on her mother's behalf. She would have to claim responsibility herself. She didn't want her father to get married because then he wouldn't belong to her anymore. By marrying Mavis, he would be calling an end to their 16-year mourning period, rapping the gavel. Time to move on. Easy enough when it was your wife, but there was no way to replace your mother. Had he bothered to think of that? There was no way to replace your mother. The hole was there forever.
How are the boys? Adrian asked. Mavis dabbed her coral lips with a napkin.
Good, good. Graham is at Gallaudet getting his master's in